once more, fill me with song. La la, kiss me once more. That'll be, that'll be.
Welcome to another edition of Raising San Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with an oldie but goodie in Donovan and Wear Your Love Like Heaven to introduce today's show, a celebration of activists and activism for more understanding, more justice, and more peace in our world. We start off talking with Laura Abraham of the Peace Cycle, which is just wrapping up another successful bicycle trip for peace in Israel and the West Bank. We also talk with a representative, one of the tour sponsors, George Rishwami of the Siraj Center for Holy Land Studies, located just outside Jerusalem. We'll also hear from citizens of the earth concerned with climate change and what we're doing to raise awareness about it in villages, towns, and cities around the world. First, though, former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert meets stiff resistance in what he may have hoped would be his victory lap around the United States. Instead of praise, however, Mr. Olmert is being accused of war crimes after the bombardment of Gaza in January and December of this year. The World Affairs Council in San Francisco hosted Ehud Olmert at the Westin St. Francis, where concerned Americans stood up and called him out on Israel's methods in Gaza and the West Bank. One by one, members of the audience got up and accused Olmert of war crimes and called for his arrest. Instead, 22 members of the audience were arrested. Here is a clip of that event.
For high crimes against the Palestinian people, especially in the Gaza Strip and the people of Lebanon.
He's a war criminal.
I'm a Palestinian. My family are in Gaza. This number of people and double the number of this join my voice by saying you are a war criminal. You've killed children. You've killed families. You've killed people. You deny them their life. Aren't you ashamed of yourself?
Sir, San Francisco.
Shame of San Francisco to have a war criminal here. Shame on us. Shame on San Francisco.
Shame on you, war criminal. White phosphorus weapons and dime explosives used against innocent people in residential areas, hospitals destroyed.
I'm sorry, but I'm tired of seeing. It's very distracting to see the blood on your hands. It's dripping from your hands, and it's all over the floor. It's going up to your knees. This is Palestinian blood. It is not right for the World Affairs Council to invite this war criminal into this. I'm not against free speech, but this is not free speech. This is not right. The World Affairs Council has no business doing this. Don't let this war criminal talk here! Let him speak in front of the International Court of Justice! Let him speak on the street, but not here! Let him back home!
If you just tuned in, we're listening to a clip from former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert's presentation for the World Affairs Council in San Francisco, California. Listen as Olmert simply continues talking about his concerns while police forcefully escort members of the audience out of the ballroom.
That is that they will have enough inside to build up a ballroom.
Don't allow a murderer to speak.
So do go ahead and answer the question.
Yes. So I think that this is the main objective, is to have enough fissile material.
It's a crime against civilians.
Syria.
Free Palestine, white phosphorus is a crime. I'm living here.
Arrest that man! Arrest that man!
I can't take this stupid man. He's a criminal. He's a baby killer. Free Palestine, white phosphorus is a crime.
That was a sample of what former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has been hearing during his presentations around the United States recently. That field recording was from the World Affairs Council's event in San Francisco. You can find it on YouTube. This is Raising Sand Radio at KZSU Standard FM 90.1. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore. I interviewed Laura Abraham of the Peace Cycle at Beit Shahur just outside Jerusalem the day after the Peace Cycle finished. It's my great pleasure to welcome to Raising Sand Radio Laura Abraham, co-founder of the Peace Cycle. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you very much, Susan. It's good to see you.
Well, it's great to have you, and this Peace Cycle is just ending. This annual Peace Cycle is just ending today.
That's right. It ended in Jerusalem.
Okay, tell us about it. How did you come up with the idea?
The issue of Palestine has been something I've cared about for a very long time, but as with many people, I've read about the situation and felt concern about it, but just didn't really know what to do, what I could do, what difference I could make. And it was actually in 2002 when the Israelis had gone into the Palestinian town of Jenin, which is in the north of the West Bank, and the Israelis had actually sealed off Jenin. And I was listening on the radio to reports of people being killed inside, of buildings being demolished on top of people, and the Israelis were not letting ambulances in and were not letting journalists in. And I just thought this was horrific, and I thought I need to do something, not just hear this, but do something about it. The idea of a bike ride actually came to me when I just happened to see a charity bike poster, and I put the two things together and met a man called Brian Moran, who was a cyclist, and he also wanted to do something to help the Palestinian people. So we came up with the idea of actually getting people to cycle from London to Jerusalem, all across Europe, with two aims, really. The ride across Europe would be to raise awareness among Europeans about what's actually happening in Israel and Palestine. And then once the ride entered Israel and Palestine, we hoped to take a message of solidarity to the people here who are working for peace, and to show the cyclists taking part the truths of the situation here, so that they can then campaign with more knowledge about what's going on.
And has that been the case?
It has. Each ride has been different. We had two that went all the way from London to Jerusalem. They were 2004 and 2006. Last year we decided to do something slightly different, and we shortened the ride so that cyclists didn't need to raise so much money for a long ride across Europe, and they could use that money to help humanitarian projects in Palestine. So we actually had cyclists riding from Amman to Jerusalem last year, and they raised £10,000, which went to medical aid for Palestinians. And this year we've done another Amman to Jerusalem ride, and cyclists this time have raised money for a mobile eye clinic for the Palestinian territories, because people find it very difficult to move around within Palestine because of the restrictions of the wall and roadblocks and checkpoints. So the project is the Ioni Mobile Eye Clinic, and it actually visits Palestinian towns and cities and villages, and gives people eye care for people who suffer from diabetes and glaucoma and preventative care, so we raise money for them. And it certainly has, I believe, met its aims, really, of helping people to see what's really going on in Israel and Palestine. The cyclists taking part this year, I've just spent a week with them, and they've just been totally shocked. Even those that had read a lot about it were so shocked, and that's why I believe it's so important for people to come here, physically come here. There's no danger in coming here. We're very well looked after, the Palestinian people, very welcoming and warm to us. But to see the wall up close right in front of your eyes is nothing like seeing it in a photograph. Mm-hmm. It's just the ugliness of it is just, it shocks you to the core. And seeing the settlement building and the way the Palestinian communities are being strangled, you have to see it with your own eyes, really. And it also brings to the Palestinians a message that they're not alone in this. You know, it's easy to think of it as a helpless situation, but I believe that if everybody tries to do something, even something small, then it's better than doing nothing, and it can make a difference.
Laura, I want to talk about how the cyclists have been received and more about some of their reactions, but who are these cyclists? Where do they come from?
We always have a very varied group of cyclists. Last year was interesting because they were all fairly young. This year, we seem to have got sort of older cyclists. We had some cyclists in their 50s and 60s. And a big variation in backgrounds. We had people from the UK, Sweden, Belgium, Cyprus, Ireland, and even someone from Canada who came all the way to take part. And there are people such as a managing director who owns a kitchen design company, as a retired solicitor. So it's kind of not the usual kind of activist type, really, which is a good thing.
It's a good thing,
yeah. People will mix in different circles, and when they leave here, they will go home and they will talk about what they've seen, and that will be, you know, will help us raise awareness among people who don't really know what's happening here.
Right. Now let's talk a little bit about how you get through the checkpoints, for example, with a group of cyclists.
It's actually fairly easy because we're international. The Palestinians are often made to wait for hours at checkpoints. But as internationals with an international passport, the Israeli soldiers usually just let us through without too many problems. So we haven't had a huge amount of problems at checkpoints. We haven't had to wait very long. But I think actually the situation with checkpoints when I came here before was really severe, and that seems actually to have eased, which you could get a false impression from. If you go through a checkpoint without too many difficulties, you could think, oh, well, what's the problem, you know, even though that checkpoint shouldn't be there under international law. It's on Palestinian territory. But what I've noticed is that the building of the wall has almost kind of taken away the need for checkpoints. I mean, there still are the checkpoints there, and some of them are causing incredible problems for the Palestinian people. But, I mean, many people don't realize that the wall is actually not built along the 1967 green line between Israeli and Palestinian territory. The wall is built deep inside the Palestinian West Bank, inside Palestinian territory, on Palestinian land. And if anyone looks at a map of the wall, you can see that the wall is actually twice as long as the so-called border between Israel and Palestine. And the reason it's twice as long is because it snakes in and out, so that it actually steals land, basically. It takes land onto the Israeli side of it. And it seems to do that in areas where there are water reserves and, of course, where there are settlements. So it's creating a situation where the Palestinian towns and villages are being encircled by the wall. So they're being strangled and cut off and isolated, not just from the outside world, from each other. So Palestinians living in one town find it now very, very difficult to visit even a neighbouring town because of the wall. That's, I think, been even more apparent to me on this ride.
Let's look at some of the towns that you went to. You went to Nazareth and Haifa, Jenin, Al-Farar, Nablus, Qalqilya, Bilin, Ramallah, Bethlehem, Hebron, and then Jerusalem. That's a good ride. And you came through the Allenby Bridge from Jordan.
No, the cyclists actually came through the Sheikh Hussein Bridge, which is the northern bridge crossing. So they went up. They in Jordan, they visited Amman and Madaba. There are Palestinian refugees living in Madaba. These are refugees from 1948. They were housed there temporarily in temporary camps. And over 60 years later, they're still waiting to be returned to their home. The cyclists visited those refugees in Madaba and then went up to the northern Sheikh Hussein crossing. And went from there to Nazareth and Haifa before entering the West Bank. There was no problem at the Sheikh Hussein Bridge, apart from there was a bit of a delay for Lauren Booth, who is actually Tony Blair's, the Middle East envoy and ex-British Prime Minister Tony Blair's sister-in-law. Mm-hmm. She was on the ride with her daughter, Alexandra.
I want to just remind our listeners that we're talking with Laura Abraham from Jerusalem today, and Laura is one of the co-founders of The Peace Cycle. You can learn more about The Peace Cycle at thepeacecycle.com. Laura, when you went into Jenin, what did you find?
In Jenin, actually, Jenin is an amazing place. It's a very resilient place. I mean, it's in the north of the West Bank. Restrictions on movement there are quite severe. It was the scene of the massacre in 2002 that inspired the peace cycle, and the centre of Jenin at that time was more or less flattened. But the people there are strong. You know, Palestinian people are very, very strong, and what always amazes me is they never seem to lose their sense of hope, their dignity. They don't want pity. They really don't want pity from the outside world. They just want to be able to live in freedom. They want what anybody would want, you know, to be able for their children to go to school and to be able to live in their own homes and to earn a decent standard of living and, you know, have holidays and, you know, have jobs. And they just want freedom, basically. Yeah. And the people of Jenin are doing a lot within their own community to build each other up. To bring up their youth with a sense of hope and pride and dignity and a sense of identity. And that's very apparent in Jenin. So you have this strange paradox everywhere we visited, in a way, that there's this awful, terrible, unjust situation, which is so shocking to see when you see a Palestinian family that's been forcibly evicted from their home and now they're in a tent outside their home. An Israeli settler is living in their home. I mean, it's almost impossible to comprehend how, in this day and age, that kind of thing is happening in a so-called civilized country. So it's shocking and in depressing in that way. But then you have this other side of the coin, which is the fact that the Palestinian people are so full of hope and energy and enthusiasm and helping each other and building each other up. So there are two sides of that coin all the time, and that's been the case in every place that we've visited.
Were there any particular incidents that stick out to you as something you really want to share?
I think one of the things was in Hebron, which was interesting because on the way to Hebron, as I said, we had Lauren Booth with us and Alexandra Darby, who is Tony Blair's niece, and on the way to Hebron we heard that Tony Blair was in Hebron. So the cyclists thought, great, you know, we want to talk to him, we want to tell him what we've seen. And they actually stood at the side of the road as his motorcade came out of Hebron, and they waved and shouted and asked him to stop. And of course, he didn't stop. He drove right past them, which I thought was interesting, the fact he'd driven right past his niece. Mm. And she actually got, when he passed, she actually said to me, kind of sadly, "Do you think my uncle saw me?" When we went into Hebron, we were met by somebody from the Hebron Rehabilitation Committee who do amazing work in Hebron. And they showed us around, and we were literally walking in Mr. Blair's footsteps. But the interesting thing was, it is an awful place where the settlers are actually living in the same buildings as the Palestinians. They've moved in above the Palestinians. And what they do is they throw their rubbish out of their windows down onto the Palestinians who are walking along in the streets. Mm-hmm. So the Palestinians have had to erect nets up above them to catch all this rubbish. And as you walk the streets of Hebron, you're walking below a net which is weighed down by Israeli settler rubbish. Mm-hmm. You just think, how can a human being do that to another human being? It's, you know, it's incredible. But I think Tony Blair had walked some of those places that we walked, but there's a particular point where you go through Ibrahimi Mosque, where the Palestinians go and worship, and you have to walk through this sort of series of ground-to-ceiling metal turnstiles. And there are Israeli armed soldiers there, and as you come through by the mosque, there's a soldier just seems to be permanently pointing his gun at you. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, we walked through there, and Alex, she's 8 years old, she was very frightened by that. And we thought, well, of course she was. She's a child. And then we thought, well, Palestinian children face that every single day. Yeah. You know, every single day. And as we went round to the other side, to another building where the rehabilitation committee is, for a meeting with them, they gave us a presentation. And a young man of about 20 came up to me, Palestinian man. And we just got chatting, and he said, thank you, I've never been to this part of Hebron. And I said, well, where are you from? And he said, oh, I'm from Hebron. And I said, well, where do you live? And he said, oh, just about 200 yards from here. Mm. And I said, well, why haven't you been to this part of Hebron? And he said, I'm too afraid to come and to move around in Hebron because of the soldiers. Mm. And we're told, you know, there are places we're not allowed to go, and the soldiers point their guns at us, and you know, quite often they're mistreated. So he was too afraid to come to this part of his city, which is just 200 yards from where he lives. And I said to him, but why are you here now? What made you come today? Because I was told 20 years he'd never come. Why today? And he said, because your group is here and you encouraged me to come. I felt safe. I felt I could come. And I followed your group. Mm. And I just thought, my goodness, you know, it's just little things like that that make you realize that it's worth doing these things. You know, you might, I don't know, everybody feels helpless in these situations, and everybody thinks, well, I'm just a normal person. I have no power. What can I do about this? But you can do something, even if you encourage one person and make one person have a bit of hope. You know, it's so worth doing. So that really sticks in my mind. And visiting another occasion in Jerusalem, we visited a family, as I mentioned earlier, who'd been evicted from their home. And they had nowhere to live. They'd been forced out of their home, and they've erected a tent opposite on the other side of the street. And we sat with them in this tent. And we just thought, winter's coming, and this family are in this tent, you know, and their home is opposite. And all the lights in the home were on, and an Israeli settler family has been moved in to this house. And I thought, that family must look out of their windows and see this tent with a Palestinian family with children and a mother and a father living in this tent. And they know that that family lived in that house and have been forcibly removed for them to come and live there. And I can't understand how people can live like that, what that must do to their souls to do that. You know, I said to somebody, there was an activist there who'd just come to be with the family to help protect them, because the families are often attacked by settlers. In fact, a boy had been attacked just the week before, an eight-year-old boy had been attacked by settlers. He was riding his bike and settlers had set about him. So international solidarity activists sometimes just go and just be with the family as a presence. And I said to her, what happens when the settlers come out of that house and they walk past this tent, knowing that they're living in this family's house? And she said, they don't even look at me, just walk past as if they're not there. And it makes me very sad for what Israel's doing to itself as well. Yeah. You know, for a country that calls itself a civilized society, and if you come into Tel Aviv airport, you think, my goodness, what a civilized country. If you don't go, you make an effort to see the other side of what's going on, you could easily think this is a fantastic, modern, civilized country, democracy, we're told. But people need to find out what's really happening, because Israel's being given money from Europe and from the States to maintain this situation. So people's tax money is going in to maintain the situation, and mm-hmm. it's inhumane. And for its own sake, Israel needs to be made to stop this. I mean, it's corrupting itself and its youth. It's as sad as what it's doing to the Palestinian people.
We're talking with Laura Abraham of The Peace Cycle. You can find it at thepeacecycle.com. Laura, next year there will be another ride?
There will, yes. We try and adapt every ride. We learn from the ride that's just taken place. I'm at the moment just talking to the cyclists. I've asked most of them, they're going home in groups now. Most of them have gone home. A few are going home over the next couple of days. But just ask them to think about things, what they've seen, how we could improve on the ride, ideas for different places we could visit, things that worked well or perhaps things that didn't work so well. And we just try and adapt that. But we'll certainly do another ride next year, possibly another Amman to Jerusalem ride or something a bit bigger. We've talked about maybe trying to do a ride to Gaza, but I'm not sure about whether that's a helpful thing to do. Mm. So we'll seek advice on that. But yes, we will certainly continue. Nothing will stop us coming here, and nothing will stop our work for justice.
Laura, thank you. Now, you're also supported by the Siraj Centre for Holy Land Studies.
Yes. They've helped us actually from the very first peace cycle. We've worked with the Siraj Centre in partnership. And George Rishmawi at the Siraj Centre and Michelle Awad have been just fantastically helpful. I always know I can trust them to put together a really good programme for us. And they make sure that we're looked after here and taken around and shown everything. We have really good guides. As I said, we go to parts of Israel as well, and we try and see every side of this situation. Mm-hmm. And they've been marvellous at helping with that. Yeah, so we like to work in partnership with them.
Well, let me talk with George Rishmawi and, have him explain the Siraj Centre so that people that are listening to the show might contact him and perhaps come to the region themselves. And if they can't bicycle, they can at least visit and see what's going on there.
Absolutely, yes. Anyone from the States would be so welcome to come. As I said, we did have a rider from Canada, and actually in 2004 on the first peace cycle, we had a married couple who came from the States. They flew to London and took part in the first peace cycle. So people from the US are very, very welcome. And if anyone wants to bring groups here for tours, then George would be more than happy to help.
Thank you so much, Laura Abraham. And that's thepeacecycle.com.
Yes, anyone can get in touch with me. My contact details are on there for more information. And thank you very much.
Thank you for all of the work and the quality of your investigation and your soul. That's Laura Abraham of The Peace Cycle. You can find out more at thepeacecycle.com. George Rishwami is director of the Siraj Center for Holy Land Studies and a sponsor of the Peace Tour. Hello, George. George Rishmawi of the Siraj Center for Holy Land Studies. Well, first, thank you for supporting the Peace Cycle. I think it's very important work that you're doing there. But you also have a center that listeners should know about.
Thanks. Siraj Center is, we do what we call alternative travel, or we do what we call meaningful and to Palestine and the Middle East.
So if somebody wants to come there, they've listened to the show, they've heard Laura on the bicycle, but they think that their health is not good enough to cycle, but nevertheless they'd like to see what's happening, they can contact the Siraj Center. And what will you offer them?
Well, so many things. First of all, Siraj Center, we organize cultural and political tours all over Palestine. And these cultural and political tours, The aim to introduce the people and their culture. We have many bus tours or car tours that we put together, fact-finding, meaningful pilgrimages, interfaith, and we organize three programs where we recruit individuals like the Palestinian Summer Celebration. People can come, live with local families, volunteer their time with local community organizations, study Arabic or history at Bethlehem University, tour the country, learn to cook Palestinian food. Mm. We recruit people right now. We have a program for the olive harvest. People can come and help Palestinian farmers harvesting their olives. We have a Christmas pilgrimages, a meaningful pilgrimages where people can meet the living community here in Palestine. We do hiking and biking. So we do all of that together, that we try to support not just show the people have a first-hand experience what does it mean to be a Palestinian, but as well we support the local economy where our local community is in need for support while they're working for it.
And are you based in Jerusalem itself?
No, we are based in Bethlehem, and we function all over the country. Jerusalem, Nazareth, Haifa, Amman, Lebanon, anywhere.
Oh, and how long are the programs?
Depends on, for example, depends who's coming and what they're looking for. You know, we don't have set itineraries. In order for us to put a program together, We ask people what they're interested in. We need to have information about the people who are coming, and we design a program that will fit their needs and to give them a first-hand experience, everything. So we can give such itineraries. Some people come for 1 week. We have people from Ireland come for 1 week only. We have people who come for 10 days or 2 weeks.
Mm.
So it depends on the people's time. And as well, you know, the longer the trip is, the more expensive it is.
Mm-hmm. And so in this case, with the peace cycle, you are the hosts of the cycle to show them around in the different towns that they visit?
We organize, you know, we're partners with the peace cycle, and we host them around. And we organize all the events for them. You know, events like the peace cycle is really, really difficult to put together. So we work with our partners all over the country, people who are now used to host the peace cycle and host events like this, where people are willing to share their experiences and share their lives with our guests from all over the world. These kind of programs, especially for the cyclists, have special needs, not like when you're traveling in an air-conditioned bus or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
These are special needs programs that now we are used and experienced in putting together. We are the host, and we put together the itinerary according to the number, and we arrange all of their accommodation and everything else.
And, George, how can people get hold of Siraj Center?
www.sirajcenter, S-I-R-A-J, Center, C-E-N-T-E-R, .org.
Thank you. This is George Rishmawi. And, George, talk a little bit about some of the feeling in the country right now. What's going on generally that people should know about?
Right now, Israel is going ahead with its unilateral plan, and Israel is confiscating 52% of the West Bank, building more walls and building more illegal settlements. This is giving us a really, really bad feeling. Checkpoints are still there. Mobility in and out of the towns is still difficult. We are really having an economy is getting worse and worse. We're affected as well by the global crisis. So, and tourism, because tourism is the largest industry in Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
People are not hopeful about what's really going on. Little bit disappointed from President Barack Obama about his promise to change. We don't feel any change. What's really happening is like worst. What we see in experience on the ground is like Israel is going ahead, although what it has been told with all the plans of land confiscation, Jerusalem is being targeted, highly targeted. People are being thrown away from their homes. Home demolition, land confiscation. Israel confiscates about 87% of the water. There are 300 communities in the West Bank that they have no running water at all. So situation here is difficult. We need more people to come and see and have a first-hand experience of it.
Okay, George Rishmawi, thank you so much for being with us. Really appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you to
thank
Laura.
You.
That was Laura Abraham of the Peace Cycle and George Rishmawi of the Siraj Center. Learn more about them at thepeacecycle.com and sirajcenter.org. You can also listen to any of our shows from our Raising Sand website. That's raisingsandradio.org. Our archive lists all of our shows and gives a brief description of each. It also takes a couple of minutes to download a show to listen at your convenience. We also segment our shows into discrete podcasts, so you don't have to download the entire show if you're particularly interested in just one segment. These are part of our MotherSpeak media package. You're free to use any of our shows, and if you air them, please credit Raising Sand Radio or MotherSpeak Media.
Imagine there's no country.
Since 1948, October 24th has been the anniversary of the entry into force of the United Nations Charter. It is marked throughout the world by meetings, discussions, and exhibitions on the achievements and goals of the organization. Here is current Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon's message for 2009. This is from his video address, and it's a, as I say, it's a video clip voiced over, and you'll hear the video sounds in the background. You can also find this clip on YouTube.
On this United Nations Day and every day throughout the year, the United Nations is at work for people, for the planet, for jobs, for you. This is a unique moment in world affairs. Many crises are hitting us at once. People everywhere are looking to the United Nations to seal the deal on climate change, to defeat poverty and hunger, to keep the peace, to stand up for human rights, to stop the spread of deadly weapons, and stop the spread of disease, to protect people and families hit by natural disaster or the global economic crisis. We are making good progress, including at this year's General Assembly session. But I'm also painfully aware of the distance to go and the gap between commitment and action. On this UN Day, we must be more united than ever, united in purpose, united in action, to make the world safer and better place.
That was Secretary General of the United Nations Ban Ki-moon's video address from the United Nations for 2009. With the United Nations Framework Conference on Climate Change to be held in Copenhagen from the 6th to the 18th of December, people around the world are urging governments to take bolder and more realistic measures to reduce carbon emissions. To keep the process on track, there is an urgent need for a new climate protocol. At the conference in Copenhagen 2009, the parties of the United Nations FCC meet for the last time at the government level before the Kyoto Protocol's climate agreement runs out in 2012. In a worldwide campaign called 350, people from 181 countries came together this October 24th for the most widespread day of environmental action in the planet's history. The title of this event, 350, refers to the science of 350, the most important number on the planet. This is the parts per billion that many scientists, climate experts, and progressive national governments are now saying is the safe upper limit for carbon dioxide in our atmosphere. At over 5,200 events around the world, from China to Ghana to New Zealand to my small hometown in Alameda, California, people gathered to call for strong action and bold leadership on the climate crisis. The International 350 campaign is dedicated to building a movement to unite the world around solutions to the climate crisis and the solutions that justice demand. The website, the 350 website, states that their mission is to inspire the world to rise to the challenge of the climate crisis and to create a new sense of urgency and of possibility on our planet. From the website, they state, "Our focus is on the number 350, as in parts per million, the level scientists have identified as the safe upper limit for CO2, carbon dioxide, in our atmosphere. But 350 is more than a number. It's a symbol of where we need to head as a planet." The website continues, "To tackle climate change, we need to move quickly and we need to act in unison. And 2009 will be an absolutely crucial year. This December, world leaders will meet in Copenhagen, Denmark, to craft a new global treaty on cutting emissions. The problem is the treaty currently on the table doesn't meet the severity of the climate crisis. It doesn't pass the 350 test. In order to unite the public, media, and our political leaders behind the 350 goal, we're harnessing the power of the Internet to coordinate a planetary day of action on October 24th, 2009. We hope to have actions at hundreds of iconic places around the world, from the Taj Mahal to the Great Barrier Reef to your community, and the clear message to world leaders, the solution to climate change must be equitable and they must be grounded in science and they must meet the scale of the crisis. If an international grassroots movement holds our leaders accountable to the latest climate science, we can start the global transformation we so desperately need. If humanity wishes to preserve a planet similar to that on which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted, paleoclimate evidence and the ongoing climate change suggests that carbon dioxide will need to be reduced from its current 385 parts per million to at most 350 parts per million. Now, I attended the event in my hometown of Alameda, California, and did field interviews on the street views and opinions of attendees. As you can tell from the sound quality, this was a field recording with all the usual ambient sounds of traffic and people, as well as the au naturel hiccups that occurred during field recordings. I spoke to Tom Christopher, who is the organizer of 350 on this island town of 75,000 across the bay from San Francisco. Tom, what is going on here today for 350?
Well, Susan, we're having a joint event today, local community organizations, Bike Alameda and CASA, which stands for Community Action for Sustainable Alameda. And the overall goal and mission of CASA is to reduce the CO2 emissions, carbon dioxide emissions, here in Alameda. And so to work on that goal, the 350.org movement today fits perfectly into our mission statement, because it wants us to reduce the CO2 emissions in any way we can, and two of the best ways are through biking and walking, and that's what we're really promoting today, bikers and walkers, and people to get out of their cars and start walking and biking to places.
I asked Tom if this was working in Alameda.
Of course it is. It's working wonderfully. When people come together, great things happen. And this is just one of 4,700 events going on throughout the world.
And what motivates Tom to spend his Saturday doing this?
It's a lot about Earth consciousness. And today we have various organizations represented. We have 511.org, as well as, like I said, Bike Alameda, which is totally about making bike lanes and making biking accessible here in Alameda. And then CASA, which works throughout our island city here of 75,000 people to make them aware of how we need to reduce our CO2 emissions, especially through driving less cars, because 57% of our emissions come from cars. We're one single united Earth community,
right?
Meaning gases, minerals, sea, plants, animals. I believe everything is living.
Right.
And so we need to respect everything.
And it's hard. It's a hard message in a country like the United States, because we're like two generations away from the Earth.
Exactly.
So.
Or yeah. 200 years if you go by the Industrial Growth Society, which, you know, we've just become unconscious.
Yeah.
And that's why I really try and promote through all these organizations. It's not that people are bad. It's just we've been unconscious.
Right.
We've been in a trance.
Right.
Like Thomas Berry says, we've just been in an industrial growth trance, and that's all we know.
Right. Yeah, and I like what you say about people not being bad. I think that we have a tendency to be, you know, one corner or the other, right or left, you know.
It's a non-dual Buddhist and other religions, you know, focus,
right,
which is so important. But yeah, as long as we have Republicans and Democrats, we're never going to get out of the dualism.
That was Tom Christopher of Alameda, the organizer of Alameda's 350 event. Dave Burton explained why he was at the event.
I'm one of the steering committee members for CASA, which stands for Community Action for a Sustainable Alameda. We're one of the groups organizing this event. We started our organization about a year ago as a way of creating a public-private partnership here in Alameda with the city government and the electric utility and Bike Alameda, Alameda Schools Go Green, and a number of other community organizations, all around the idea of reducing carbon emissions in town and meeting the goals of the Alameda's local action plan for climate protection. Had some pretty good success here in our first year.
Dave Burton reports that the city found that 54% of emissions on the island are directly attributable to transportation, cars, buses, and ferries, and they are focusing on ways to induce Alameda's citizens to bike more and walk more. Jeff Kambara with Bike Alameda described his organization.
Bike Alameda is an advocacy organization here in the city of Alameda. We advocate for better conditions for bicyclists so that they can get out of their cars. We specifically look to try and make the roads 8 to 80. So whether you're 8 years old or 80 years old on a three-wheel bicycle, you'll feel comfortable biking in Alameda.
And so people are riding bikes a lot more now?
People are riding bikes a lot more, but we're trying to make the roads a little safer. People have perceptions about riding on the roads. And while we have bike lanes in many areas, statistics show that the more bike lanes you have, the more comfortable people feel about riding to their specific destinations. We also look for alternate routes to be able to get to those locations. In fact, last year, Bike Alameda sponsored a bike plan update ride where we identified 6 of the most popular locations in the city and tried to point out the inadequacy of the bike lanes to get to those locations, with the idea of over the next year working towards improving that and getting people out of their cars.
And Jeff, do you think the issues that Alameda is looking at as a little island city is something that most other cities looking to go more towards bicycles dealing with also?
I think every city has to deal with that. Whether you're an island or not, it gets from the point of having people commute from one part of their city to another. And whether you're an island or not, for Alameda, we have to deal a little more with how do you get off the island, though, if you want to take an alternate form of transportation.
It was Jeff Kambara of Bike Alameda. Alameda City Councilwoman Lena Tam was there too.
I'm Lena Tam. I serve on the Alameda City Council, and this is City Hall, and we have a 5-member council, a separately elected mayor in our city, and the issues of sustainability is very important to our city. We have just passed on Tuesday night a green building ordinance that calls for putting in place certain measures for new building construction to make sure that they're sustainable. I think it's very important that we have partnerships with the community, like CASA, which stands for Communities in Alameda for Sustainable Action, because only 3% of the greenhouse gas emissions are actually produced by the city of Alameda's operations and facilities. The majority is really from transportation within the city, and so we really encourage people to find options to get out of their cars, to take public transit, bike, and walk.
Is the city council coming up with incentives for people to do that?
We have an EcoPass program here for our employees, for example, that basically give them free access to AC Transit so they can take the bus to work if they can. And we, in all of our newer facilities like the library and the parking structure and the movie theater, we try to put bike racks for bike parking. And we have a lot of, community interest. So there's a number of community meetings with our Alameda Power and Electric Company, which I think is now at 85% renewable in terms of its energy portfolio.
Wow, that's pretty amazing.
It is. It's great.
Councilwoman Lena Tam went on to describe that the city of Alameda doesn't get its power from the local huge utility company, Pacific Gas and Electric, but owns and runs its own electric company and partners with Northern California Power Authority and gets its power from hydro, geothermal, and cogeneration plants. I mentioned that my power rates actually in Alameda were very reasonable.
Our power rates are definitely lower than the surrounding communities, and I think it's a real testament to the commitment that the citizens and residents of Alameda have.
Well, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you very much for coming.
That was City Councilwoman Lena Tam. Now, Bill McKibben is one of the major overall organizers of 350 around the world, and he sent a letter to organizers at all of the events all over the world, and I asked Ann Christopher to read the letter here.
The first thing I'd like to say to you today is that you're part of something very large. There are more than 4,000 events like this happening all around the world in more than 170 nations, in dozens of languages, in every time zone, and on every continent, in the heat and the cold, under the sun and pouring rain and snow. But everyone who is involved shares at least one thing, the deep conviction that it is up to us at this exact moment in our history to come together in defense of this planet and the people on it. We rally around the number 350 because it is the safe upper limit of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere, and so 350 defines what is necessary for the Earth to continue as we have known it. We have relied upon the patterns of rainfall and ice and sea level that have marked this world for the 10,000 years of human civilization. If these patterns shift dramatically, the first victims will be the people living closest to the edge, people who have already begun to suffer from drought, from flood, from the spread of disease. We will not stand by and let that happen. The second thing I'd like to say today is that you're part of something that matters. The climate crisis is such a huge issue that it's always hard to see what difference any of us can make, especially when our foes include some of the most powerful entities on Earth. We can't match them in money, but they can't match us in numbers, in spirit, in dedication. And we have a secret weapon, which is the power that comes from scientific observation. Today, we are taking that number, 350, and making it the centerpiece of the debate over climate observation. We are reminding the world's leaders that they can give all the speeches they want, but that won't change the way that physics and chemistry operate. We are standing up for scientific reality, and in so doing, reframing this debate in a way that will echo through the United Nations climate talks in Copenhagen and beyond. And the last thing I would like to say today is more personal. It's a great privilege to be able to get out of bed in the morning and think to yourself, there's nothing more important than this that I could be doing today. Take a moment to think about the amazing fact that across the globe today, people are doing just what you're doing, hoping just what you're hoping, believing just what you're believing. And together, we are making these deeds, hope, and belief add up to something truly transformational. Right now, today, October 24th, there is nothing more vital to the planet's future that you could be doing. No deeper way to honor those who came before us or to show your love for those who will come after. Thank you so much for coming.
The Alameda Community Chorus got in on the act, too, and they shared a clip from a piece they did for their spring concert using Chief Seattle's words, "This We Know." That was 350, as celebrated in Alameda, California. You can learn more at casawiki.org. And that's our show for today. As usual, views and opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. Contact me at susan@raisingsandradio.org and visit our website at raisingsandradio.org.
And the world.